you to Lars especially for including me in the program at a kind of a late date. But I noticed on the schedule there are 4 talks in the afternoon about high redshift supernovae and the cosmological applications of type 1a supernova high redshift. And I think one of the underappreciated parts of this enterprise is the low redshift sample. So I wanted to just kind of talk about how it's important to the cosmological efforts. So here's a plot from Michael Woods Vasey's paper from the ESSENCE sample showing 2 recent high redshift supernova results from SNLS and ESSENCE, and we're going to hear about those later. So in this plot, in the Hubble diagram, there's also this nearby sample, and here you can see the numbers, 120 at these redshifts, and the nearby sample, which I'm going to define practically as the objects less than redshift of 0.15, they're actually critical to the cosmological effort. And there are a number of reasons for that, but the most important reason is that they anchor the Hubble diagram essentially independent of omega matter, lambda, and W. So in the residual plot, if you look at this, if you imagine you didn't have any of these red points, you can see that the shapes of the curves depend on cosmology. So these are 3 different sets of cosmological parameters. But this zero point, the residual, is defined by a combination of both the Hubble constant and the intrinsic luminosity of a type 1a supernova. So if you didn't have these objects, which are insensitive to the cosmological differences, you would be free to move these curves up and down on this plot. And you can pretty easily convince yourself you could take the omega matter equals 1 model and just move it up to fit all of these points reasonably well. And so if you didn't have a low redshift sample, the degeneracies in the cosmological effort would be very huge. And if you now look just at the numbers that are in this plot, 45 versus 120, you can see that a lot of the statistical uncertainty in the cosmological parameters that you're trying to measure up here come from the sample down here. And so I really wanted to focus on what this sample is and what its future is. So that's why it's important for cosmology, but also this sample is the sample from which we get the empirical correlations that we can make such a plot with precise distances. So these are the ones that we learned about the Phillips relation from. We learned about how to correct for extinction. It's much harder to do up here where the data is not as good. And just to reiterate that point, these are the objects that are studied in greatest detail. So not only do we have photometry and the optical filters like we do for the high redshift, but we have really good spectra of these objects. We have spectra of polarimetry of these objects. We have near infrared. We have UV. So this is, and you know, this is where we learn about type 1a supernovae. And so, you know, this nearby sample is really critical in a lot of aspects, and you know, hasn't really gotten the attention I think that it deserves. And in fact, you know, the amount of, you know, the effort that goes into collecting high Z supernovae really I think should be matched in an effort at low Z. And that's beginning to happen, but I just want to emphasize that point. Okay, so I just want to tell you what is the modern sample of the low Z supernovae, and I decided to classify them based on the detector. So first, the first detector you use for things that we think are really type 1a supernovae, so Tycho's famous supernovae that we heard a bit about. And now, you know, from Carlos and other evidence, we think that maybe Kepler's was a type 1a. The light curve for Kepler's isn't as clear to me to be a type 1a as the light curve that Pilar made for Tycho. But someone did say that, you know, Kepler was a theorist, so maybe that explains it. I didn't say that, but someone did. Anyway, then that's the prehistoric observations in this classification. Then we moved basically in the early 20th century and basically until the 70s, photographic type 1a supernovae. And they're actually, you know, I say a question mark because they were only classified as type 1s. We don't know if they're really type 1as. You know, some of them have good spectra that we can sort of tell they were 1as. But with photographic photometry, there are lots of problems. So Herodotus was the chronicler of the of ancient history. And for our purposes, the Bruno is the chronicler. And so in his thesis, he's gotten all the data from, you know, basically 1895 down to 1990s, all the photographic data, and we don't use any of it anymore. So sorry, but it's very interesting for historical purposes. After that was the photoelectric age, which basically from the 70s to the mid 80s. And here there are a few well-studied objects. I have to include 72E in the modern sample, otherwise I wouldn't have graduated. So here there are a handful of objects that we kind of know by name, and it's the beginning of the modern age. But really, the modern sample comes from CCD photometry from the mid-1980s to the present. Here we have the secure spectra. We know that these are 1As. We can distinguish them from 1Bs and 1Cs at this epoch. We have high-precision multicolor photometry. We have the development of Mark Phillips' relation to correlate the light curve shape and luminosity, and the advent of the large homogeneous surveys. I wanted to find a picture of the whole Kalantolo group, but all I got were stamps. So apparently in Chile, the Kalan and Tololo have stamps, which is kind of cool. So today, what is the modern sample that we actually use for high redshift cosmological applications? So it really starts with the Kalantolo survey. This was a photographic search and CCD follow-up. It was a great thing where you go look for the supernovae, taking pictures of the sky, and follow them up with CCDs. Their whole sample was 29 objects observed in BV and I. Some of them also had R-band photometry. The mean redshift was 13,500 kilometers a second, so Z of 0.045 roughly. And this redshift is going to be important as I sort of go through the talk. This really was the groundbreaking work. So it established the Phillips relation, delta M15 versus luminosity in BV and I. Here's the Hubble diagram just from the Kalantolo before the Phillips relation and correcting for it. These exclude extinguished objects. But anyway, I don't want to get into the details of the plots too much, but this really was the first modern sample, and it's to this sample that we owe a lot of the development of the applications of type 1A cosmology. Okay, roughly at the following that, at CFA, we began a follow-up project, so a follow-up of other people's discoveries, and this has been published in two volumes now. Adam Rees published the first CFA sample with 22 objects, BVRI photometry here. The mean redshift is lower, so the Kalantolo search went deeper than the searches that we were using to find to follow up on supernovae. And then after that, so this was from 1993 to 96, was 22 objects. From 1997 to 2000, there was more of an emphasis on 1As, and we added the U-band, but the mean redshift was decreasing as we could follow objects that other people had discovered, and this is where people were discovering them, not as deep as the ones that the Kalantolo lobes discovered. Okay, so this, Tom showed this, but these are some light curves, and we don't really need to dwell on that. Okay, there are other papers that go into the modern sample. Kevin Kersiounis has a series of papers on data from Apache Point when he was at Washington and at Cerro Chololo with a number of objects, so 19 over this period. ESO published a big compendium of their objects from 1991 to 2000 in this paper by Altavilla et al. And there are a lot more papers with just individual or a few objects. I kind of wanted to focus on the big samples that really define the bulk of the thing. So if you then take those light curves and apply them through some distance-fitting methodology, or you correct for the intrinsic luminosity variations and the extinction, you can put them on the Hubble diagram. And here's 127 of them, so basically the whole modern sample that we have, on a redshift versus magnitude plot. And so there's some interesting things about this plot. You can see there are error bars in both directions. So in the distance direction, the error bar so this is a corrected magnitude. The error in the corrected magnitude comes basically from how good the light curve is. If we have a lot of filters, if we have a lot of good data, we can get this error down to approximately 0.15 magnitudes or so in this direction. In the x-axis, this is a log-log plot, basically. In the x-axis, the error bar that I put here is an estimate. We only measure the radial velocity of the galaxy, but we don't know if that's the true cosmological velocity because there's its neighbors are tugging on it at some level. And so these error bars are assumed 300 kilometer per second peculiar velocity for each object. And you can see down at the lower end, it's quite significant, the peculiar velocity. Okay, one thing about this plot, this line, the slope of this line is fixed by the fact that distance is supposed to be proportional to redshift, the Hubble law, and that light should fall off, the flux should fall off as 1 over d squared. So the only thing you're allowed to adjust in this plot is the normalization of that line. And again, that is a combination of both the Hubble constant and the intrinsic brightness of a type 1A. There's some interesting things you can see that here the peculiar velocities dominate. But for instance, you see this one object, which is an outlier. It's actually in a cluster, and it has a peculiar velocity of over 1,000 kilometers per second. If you actually just use the cluster mean velocity for this object, it moves right over there, right onto the line. So you can already see from this there are some interesting applications here. One of them is what I just said before, is the Hubble constant. So to do the Hubble constant, you would like to avoid the effects of peculiar velocities. You want to measure the global Hubble constant. And so that means you want to focus on a region where the uncertainty from the velocities is less than or comparable to the uncertainty in the distance, which is, you know, actually this is a little bit high, but I'm just saying 10% here. The problem is that what you can measure from these objects is this combination of the intrinsic magnitude and the Hubble constant. So somehow, to break that, you need to know one or the other. And since you're trying to measure the Hubble constant, that means you need to know the intrinsic magnitude. So one way is from theory. And so I was hoping by day three someone would tell me what it was, but that didn't seem to happen. So another way is to go out and measure it and tie it to other distances. And so the distance method of choice right now is Cepheids. But even with ACS, long live ACS, this is the limit to which you can find Cepheids in galaxies. It corresponds to a magnitude limit for the supernova of about 13. So down here, and WIFPIC 2 is probably a half magnitude below that. So these galaxies, you could look for Cepheids. Unfortunately, the big problem here is you notice there are no galaxies in this region where you could find Cepheids, and they're in the smooth Hubble flow. So that's why you have to tie these galaxies to the supernovae in here. This is kind of an old slide, but when people did that, and depending on the Cepheid distances they got from the same data, they got completely different Cepheid distances, which meant completely different absolute magnitudes for the supernovae, which meant completely different Hubble constants. So these are the same HST data, the same supernova distances, and this big difference in H0. And so, you know, that kind of led to this, well, is 10% really the best we can do with H0 from supernovae? I think the answer is no, and we'll hear about that. I think the next year or two, there'll be some exciting new results. Adam Riess did a study using only four of these objects, actually only two of these objects and a couple more, four ideal calibrators, which these errors were less, and the supernovae had less problems, less dust and stuff like that. This was his result. And we think that we might be able to get 5% in the near future by bypassing one of the big systematic errors, which isn't even included on this plot, the distance to the LMC, by using the distance to NGC 4258, which is known from its maser in its center. And we have a geometrical distance to that galaxy. So we can do Cepheids in that galaxy with ACS and then compare them to Cepheids also measured with ACS in other galaxies. And Adam has also gone one step beyond that to do near IR photometry of those Cepheids where extinction is less of a problem. So there is the hope of 5% or even better result on the Hubble constant from supernovae in the very near future. Okay. Another plot you can do is, as I said before, down here where the errors actually are dominated by the velocity component, well, you can assume that these, you know, should be following the Hubble flow, and so what you're really measuring here are peculiar velocities. So in this region, you can make a plot like this, where you plot the peculiar velocities of the supernovae on the sky. And so red means the supernova was moving away from us relative to the Hubble expansion. Blue is the opposite, coming towards us relative to the Hubble expansion. And the size of the symbol is the size of the amplitude of that peculiar velocity. And if you plot it on the sky, you see this dipole, and these squares are the position and amplitude of the CMB dipole. You see, we don't find too many supernovae near the galactic plane, and so that's why, and these stars are the best fit dipole from the supernovae themselves. So you can see they're shifted a bit from the squares, but given that we don't have too many objects in here, these are actually quite consistent. You can do a much more sophisticated analysis of this data, but it shows you the power of using supernovae as distance indicators. You can recover our local group's motion through the universe. There is a more sophisticated analysis done here, and there are a couple more in progress.
Why are there so few on the right hand?
So this is basically the lack of a lot of searches in the southern hemisphere. I think the Colantololo has a few of these, but many of their objects were beyond this cutoff where the errors get very big to measure the peculiar velocity. So we really would like a more nearby search in the southern hemisphere. And there are a couple that are starting up. Okay. So for cosmology, we don't need to actually know the absolute magnitude of the supernovae from down here. We just need to know that combination of absolute magnitude and H0, which is given by these objects here. So then the question is, okay, well, where should we define a smooth Hubble flow? So here's one where I said sigma velocity was less than or equal to sigma distance. The real question is, let me just blow up that region. So this is a Hubble diagram in what we call the Hubble flow from about, we used about 2500. You can make different guesses about where that is. And you can see the dispersion around that is 0.18 magnitudes, which is about 9% in distance. If you take into account this peculiar velocity effect, it's about 7% in distance. The different surveys have used different Hubble flow zones. Trying, you know, if it was just really random peculiar velocity errors, you could just deweight these points by the increasing error bars. But you know, we're afraid that there might be some correlated things because large scale structure in the universe will correlate these flows. And so the high Z surveys have tried to cut down on that problem by going to higher limits. The problem, of course, as you can see when you do that, is that you get less objects up here, and so you're trading statistical error for systematics. So one of the systematics that in a recent paper we've talked about is what we call the Hubble bubble. It's an idea that goes back to Zahavi et al. And even further. And if you just plot the Hubble constant, essentially you get from all the different supernovae individually, and it's really the relative Hubble constant, the absolute value doesn't matter. There's this feature which shows up at some significance, let's say 2.5 sigma, that the nearby ones give you a Hubble constant that's higher than the ones that are further away. And it's, this difference is about 6%, and it's at a scale of 100 megaparsecs, and it's roughly isotropic on the sky. So we've done a lot of tests about the significance of this. It's about 2.5 sigma, but it's robust to particular subsamples that you choose, and we've tried a couple other distance fitters on this, and it seems to agree. The effect of this on cosmology actually can be quite significant. Since you're using this sample as the anchor of the high redshift Hubble diagram, it makes a big difference if you use this sample, or the whole thing when you measure, for instance, W versus omega matter. So here's a simulated essence sample. We should actually go ahead and redo this plot with the real sample. But it basically, we've seen the same effect. If you use these data, you would get this error curve in W. If you use these data, you'd get this one. And if you use all of them, you get the one in the middle. So you can see there's quite a big effect of, you know, 20% here in W. And this is why the high Z papers have been using, you know, trying to avoid this effect by using the higher redshift region. Of course, we don't know that that's necessarily the right thing to do. That would be the right thing to do if it really is a real local void in the universe that's causing this, because then these supernovae are sampling the global properties better. But it could be a systematic error in the data, or it could be something to do with the distance fitting. So there are a bunch of possibilities that we're trying to investigate. And of course, the answer is to get more data. I know that there is one real Hubble bubble in the universe, and there it is. So this is these are both toy models, as you can see, but I was pretty happy to see. Basically, the other things I want to talk about is the low redshift sample also kind of gives us a hint as how we might be able to sharpen our tools. So we can measure distances maybe to supernovae to 7 or 10% at high redshift. Well, are there any clues to improve that? And here's two plots of the residual from the Hubble diagram versus here host galaxy morphology, and here the projected distance from the center of the host galaxy. And you can see there are regions like here in the early type galaxies or here far away from their hosts where the dispersion seems to be lower. And it's significantly lower, actually. The one interesting thing in here is in the early type galaxies, these are more fast declining subluminous supernovae. But out here, these are pretty normal supernovae. So to me, these two pieces of evidence are pointing to the biggest problem in our distances right now is battling dust extinction, which is higher here and higher here. And if we avoid dust, we can do better. And so the intrinsic dispersion of subsamples of data could be as low as, you know, maybe 3% distances per object with type 1a supernovae if we restrict ourselves to these subsamples. So that's a study that we would like to do with both the nearby and the high redshift data, and things have been done along those lines. But I really think that the future of type 1a cosmology may be, well, let's find thousands of supernovae and use the ones that give the best distance indicators rather than worry about systematics due to things like dust. Okay, so just to wrap up on the future supernova samples, so these are the ones I think are coming out tomorrow, which I mean in the next year or two. And so we've heard from Weidong about the LIC observatory supernova search. So the current sample from 98 to 2004 is about 96 type 1a supernovae, mean redshift about 6,000 that Mo is writing up. And so Weidong showed this plot, so showing that LIC, I mean, the thing I need to really point out at KATE is that, you know, it's both search and follow-up, and that's, you know, one of the unique things about it. It's the world's most successful nearby supernova search. Here are two of the Kate light curves. And just to show you the distance fitting with how it works, kind of, here are the distances you get for these two objects. It's good that they agree because they're in the same galaxy. They have different amounts of extinction and different intrinsic luminosities, but you get the distances recovered. We don't have that many tests like that, so it's nice that things pass that test. Here's the preliminary Hubble diagram from this sample. Here's the new Kate data. There are 82 red objects compared to the blue, the black ones. And you know, just this morning I looked at the Hubble bubble effect in the new data, and you can actually kind of see it already. These points are a little bit low, and these points are high. And so I think the Hubble bubble is still in the Kate data, which is a completely independent sample. So that points to either it being a fitter issue or you know something real in the universe. Malcolm Hicken at CFA is doing another sample, this, there we go. The CFA3 sample, so they've been continuing, and actually they've been ramping up the number of objects they've been observing. So here's his 80 light curves that he showed in a poster at AAAS, so that should be coming out soon. We heard from Mark, so I don't have to, I had Carnegie Supernova Project, so I was busily changing that in the middle of the talk. But the really great thing about this is you know, the 100 supernovae, but this huge wavelength coverage. Right now we have UBVRI for maybe half of the modern sample. This is going to be really great, so we're really looking forward to that. And 35, or I guess 32 is the number, maybe get maybe being published imminently. I don't know if Andrew Carnegie is looking up at supernovae, but I think the optical depth is a little high. But here's one for 2005 HK. This is the CSP light curve, and you can see this huge wavelength coverage. The Sloan 2 project, so for Sloan, the interesting thing is that, you know, ZF.15 becomes a very arbitrary limit in the Sloan redshift distribution for the supernovae that we find in Sloan. But there will be about 40 a year at below that cutoff. So Sloan will really help both the low redshift and the intermediate redshift population. We'll hear Peter Garnovich talk about that. Roland Thomas will talk about the nearby supernova factory. They have integral field unit spectrophotometry. So it'll be really interesting to see if we, from those data, you can recover the light curves and all the correlations that we're interested in, and if they add more to it, because we can look for spectral feature variations. And then in the future, SkyMapper and PanSTARRS and things will. So the Dark Energy Task Force report requires that we have 500 nearby type 1a supernovae to reach the precision envisioned in these stage 2 and stage 3 experiments. So, you know, you may not hear about that number very often. And, you know, so the modern sample has 100 now. We may add another couple hundred here. But to get to 500, that's a significant effort. And if we're going to start making subsample cuts to only use the best ones, then we really have to find a lot more nearby supernovae. And so we're on our way there, but I really think that a lot of effort and thought and money should go into the low redshift part of this program, because it's as important as the high redshift. You won't learn the cosmology you want to know unless you make that similar effort. And I'll end there. Thanks.
So Robin, in your point about using only things that are in ellipticals or far away from the galaxies, how could that produce scatter? I would think that would just make things, if it was dust, it would make supernovae fainter in the...
So the real reason is that we try and correct for the dust on an individual supernova by supernova basis. And so there are two competing effects. One is there's an intrinsic color variation because supernovae are just slightly different colors. And then that's our only handle on the dust in these distance fitting methods. So when we correct for the intrinsic color variations, we're multiplying that color by some factor, R of 3 or 2 or whatever it is, and that's going to affect our distances. So in these populations, in the ellipticals or far away, the only part that contributes to dispersion is the intrinsic color variation, which we don't have to now multiply by some factor because we know that, you know, the dust is low. And so that could be the reason why the dispersion also decreases. It's just that we're not doing the correction right or as well as we, you know, could if there were no dust.
I apologize for inflicting my ignorance upon you, but that you mentioned this effect on the Hubble constant and for the supernovae that are closer to us. How does that relate to our knowledge of the mass density across as a function of redshift, you know, things like a 2DF survey or...
Yeah, it doesn't very well. That's why I'm not convinced that it's a real effect in the universe. And I think, you know, it's quite equally likely it's something to do with the supernovae.
Okay, so at that velocity, you don't see anything that's...
There are mass concentrations at that velocity, but people who have done galaxy surveys don't, you know... The other thing that I didn't mention, if you do run CDM models for, you know, how often you would get this 6% bubble, that actually corresponds to a 20 to 30% under density in that whole very large region, 100 megaparsecs. That's very rare, and it's even rarer to find yourself in a galaxy in one of those. The statistics are hard, but it's something like, you know, you're down at a 5 sigma low fluctuation to be in that. So that's why I think there's some sound arguments from other distance indicators and from theory that you know, a local void of that size doesn't seem to be right. On the other hand, we're getting more supernova data, and it always seems to show up. So I think there's some kind of effect there that's important.
Well, the other point is you have to sit pretty close to the center of that hole or of the bubble, otherwise you wouldn't see it. And so
if you weren't near the center, you would see it as an isotropy in the other plot that I showed with the flows.
Yes,
so,
that's right. But it's becoming very hard.
Yeah.
Sirab, I wanted to know, in the Hubble bubble picture that you have there, does the morphology change as you move across of the hosts, the mean morphology?
Yeah,
time I looked at it, it seemed like there was an overdensity of ellipticals, and then it went to spirals later, so.
Yeah, so there is a big change. Well, I mean, there is a change as you go across that, and that's what, so the reason is that many of the objects beyond the Hubble bubble are from the Kalon-Tololo. Because it was a higher mean redshift, and that's why I was giving the mean redshifts a little bit throughout the talk. And many of the more nearby ones are in more spirals, and there's also an extinction effect that Lifan has pointed out. The ones more nearby have higher extinction, so it could be something to do with the extinction corrections. On the other hand, I have done it with everything, you know, not using the Kalon-Tololo at all, just all the modern stuff. And then I've just done it this morning, in fact, with just the new KATE sample, you know, which is all new, and it shows up in all of those samples. So it's hard for me to jibe with just a selection effect in terms of the galaxies or the extinction.
Yeah. So, Rob, you just now peripherally brought up what I wanted to ask you about, but since some people have heard Lifan's talk and others will soon hear it, maybe you could address it?
Sure. So...
Basically, while Sirab's getting it, Lifan does not get a Hubble bubble of any sort.
So I don't know if that's the right...
His conclusion was that it's not there. Okay.
Sorry.
I paraphrase.
Okay, so what Lifan did, he actually, I don't know what his results are with using his C-Magic distance indicators, and so I don't know what the answer to that is if he did it with his distance fitter. But what he pointed out from our paper was that if you plot the Hubble flow residual versus extinction, he noticed, so we can ignore these very high extinction points, he thought that there was a trend that went like this, and so he fit for this trend. And then he took that trend out, and then he looked at the Hubble bubble analysis, and it became much less significant. So what he said was that, first of all, I'm not sure that this trend is significant, but he said it was. I just have to go through and repeat his analysis. But my only point is that the reason that he did that is that his premise is that the distance residual should be independent of the extinction in the host. And that makes sense. If you think about it, you know, supernovae at Z of 0.01 should not be extinguished in any different way than supernovae at Z of 0.05, for instance. The problem I have with that argument is that's true in the ideal sample, but in the real sample, there are selection effects, even at nearby, where the ones at Z of 0.05 are going to be less extinguished than the ones at zero. And we can see that in the data. And so the point is that if there were a Hubble bubble, now I'm not saying it's true, and you had a selection effect that correlated extinction with distance, then you would see exactly this effect, and you would be taking out the whole bubble by doing this fit. So this is why I think going to new samples and, you know, samples which are deep enough to find the similar objects, or for instance, you know, only looking at objects with a certain small range of extinction with, you know, more data, that would be the way to solve
right.
that issue.
So the bias you're saying exists because we don't find at higher distances the more extinguished objects.
Right. It's the same bias we see at high redshift because, you know, all these surveys have a particular limiting magnitude.
Yeah.
And Fontolelo was a little harder than that because it was a photographic search. And
right.
so if you just plot, for instance, AV versus distance, you know, the most extinguished objects are nearby,
yeah.
very nearby.
Well, this is a concern because, as Wei Dong showed, we have some limiting magnitude cutoff,
right.
but you add some extinction and we're not going to find.
So the real way to do it is just look at a sample where, you know, even if there were a linear correlation, whatever the correction might be, it's the same if you take a very narrow range of extinction. So if we had a huge sample with low extinction, we could do this measurement independent of any extinction correction.
Sarab, could you mimic any of this Hubble bubble if there's an error in the sort of mean or zero point of the Schlegel, Finkbinder, Davis galaxy maps, so, you know, things at low redshift versus then when you're seeing them at slightly redshifted light, and if we weren't properly correcting because we didn't have the right zero point of how much dust there is in the Milky Way.
Yeah, I thought a little bit about it. I think a lot of those effects would have been very obvious in the high redshift. I mean, because here the differences you're talking about is a redshift between 0.01 or 0.02 to 0.03 to 0.04. That's pretty small compared to, you know, so it would take really serious errors to really affect it that much, and a 0.1 magnitude effect at that redshift would, for the Schlegel, for instance, if that was the answer, would translate into like a half a magnitude effect as you went to higher redshift.
But the higher redshift stuff we target in regions with low galaxy extinction, whereas these are all over the sky.
Right. So I mean, you can restrict yourself to low extinction, but most of them are not much higher extinction than the high redshift. But I think there, you know, there could be some effects like that, but or K corrections, for instance, nearby. But I don't think they can produce a tenth of a magnitude shift in the mean. We don't think the errors are that large.
But with K corrections, I mean, you've said that you've done this with different surveys now, like the Kate survey you see, and then the old CFA survey or the Quantel. I mean, those are different filter functions, and so you must have those
right. Well,
S corrections
under
control.
If our underlying spectral model were wrong, then it might affect all of them the same way. But I don't think, you know, I think maybe Peter can comment, but I don't think that the differences in the spectral model are so significant that it could produce that huge an effect at those low redshifts. So.
Our next speaker.